You know, there is this classic horror movie trope where the main character is sitting in this perfectly quiet room
Oh, yeah.
and they just start hearing a sound. Like maybe it's a faint whisper or this rhythmic scratching or I don't know, a really high-pitched whine.
Right.
So they turn to their friends and ask, like, "Hey, do you hear that?" And they just get these total blank stares back. The sound is entirely in their head.
Yeah, which is just the ultimate form of psychological isolation.
Exactly. It's your own brain essentially gaslighting you.
It is a terrifying concept to watch on screen. And yet, I mean, for millions of people tuning into this right now, it isn't a movie trope at all. It's literally just a Tuesday morning.
Yeah. So, welcome to the deep dive. Today, our mission is to take this massive stack of lecture slides and clinical notes from Professor Ali Dinesh.
He's an absolute authority out of Florida Atlantic University, by the way. Labyrinth Audiology.
Right, so we're taking all his research and extracting the ultimate shortcut to understanding a condition that might be driving you or, you know, someone you know completely crazy.
We are, of course, talking about tinnitus.
That phantom ringing. And its really aggressive cousin, hyperacusis.
Yeah, and to really understand the treatments that are available today, we actually have to look backward first. We have to look at how we first categorize the actual physical cause of all this.
Okay, let's unpack this. Where do we start?
Well, the U.S. government officially recognized environmental noise as a severe health hazard way back in 1972.
Wait, 1972?
Yeah, with the Noise Pollution and Abatement Act. They realized back then that a loud environment isn't just, you know, an annoyance that gives you a headache.
Right.
It is an actual public health crisis that actively destroys human tissue.
I really want to spend some time on that biological destruction because when we talk about a loud concert or like heavy machinery damaging your ears, it sounds so abstract to
Oh,
people.
for sure. It just sounds like general wear and tear.
Exactly. But the clinical notes here get incredibly specific about the biology of noise-induced hearing loss. I mean, the physical risk actually begins at just 70 decibels.
Which is surprisingly low.
It is. For context, if you're listening to this while running your washing machine, or if you're just sitting in a busy restaurant, you are hovering right around that 70 decibel mark.
Yeah.
And what happens inside the ear when you sustain that kind of noise over a long period is, honestly, it's brutal.
It is essentially a microscopic war zone in there. I mean, chronic noise exposure causes acute metabolic damage to the cochlea, which is the spiral cavity of the inner ear. Specifically, the noise triggers apoptosis and necrosis of these highly delicate inner and outer hair cells.
Okay, wait, I want to clarify that. So necrosis is what you might expect.
Yeah, it's the violent death of a cell from just sheer mechanical trauma. You hit it too hard, it dies.
But apoptosis is wilder.
It really is. It means the sensory cells become so metabolically stressed by the constant sound waves that they literally trigger their own self-destruct sequence.
They actively dismantle themselves.
Exactly. And these aren't just random cells we're talking about.
Yeah.
These hair cells are the critical mechanical receptors that physically bend. They translate the acoustic sound waves from the air into the electrical signals your brain can actually understand.
And once they trigger that self-destruct sequence and die, they just don't grow back.
No, human beings totally lack the regenerative biology to replace them. Once they're gone, they're gone.
Which brings us to the calling card of this whole process. Audiologists look for something called the 4,000 hertz hearing notch.
Right, the classic notch.
Yeah. When you look at a patient's hearing test, their audiogram, their hearing is usually relatively normal in the lower pitches. And then right at 4,000 hertz, the graph just plummets into this massive V shape.
Because that specific frequency is crucial. It's where all the high-frequency speech sounds live.
Yeah, so if you are listening to this right now and you've noticed recently that you can hear people talking, but it sounds like everyone around you is just constantly mumbling.
That is exactly what's happening.
Right. The low-frequency vowel sounds are still coming through loud and clear, but those crisp, high-frequency consonant sounds like the S, the F, the T, T, they just vanish from your world.
And what takes their place is the tinnitus.
And the prevalence of this is just staggering. I mean, globally, depending on the study you look at, anywhere from about 5% to nearly 43% of people experience it.
It's a huge range, but it's a massive portion of the population.
Yeah, and it tends to increase as we age, and it's notably more common in men.
Probably due to historical occupational hazards,
Yeah.
right? Like heavy industry and the military.
Right. But wait, I need to pause on the mechanics here for a second.
Sure.
If the damage is physical, like, let's say, snapping a string on a piano, why does the person hear a continuous ringing sound?
That is the million-dollar question.
Right, because if the string is broken, shouldn't you just experience silence in that specific 4,000 hertz frequency? Like, why is there a new noise?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the human auditory system absolutely abhors a vacuum. When those hair cells die, they abruptly stop sending electrical signals to the auditory cortex in the brain.
So there's just a dead zone.
Exactly. The brain notices this sudden lack of input, and it essentially turns up its internal microphone to compensate. It becomes hyperactive, just frantically searching for a signal that no longer exists.
Wow.
Yeah. So the ringing you hear isn't actually coming from your ear at all. It is the sound of your own brain's neurons firing on a continuous loop in this desperate attempt to hear something.
It's like an auditory phantom limb.
An auditory phantom limb, yes. Perfect way to describe it.
That makes an uncomfortable amount of sense, honestly. But because it is a phantom and because the physical hair cells are permanently gone, you can't just glue the piano string back together.
No, you really can't. Because the inner ear cannot be fully repaired with our current medical science, prevention is literally the only true cure we have.
Right.
The notes emphasize this ABC of noise protection, absorption, blocking, and covering. You have to actively defend those hair cells using earplugs or, you know, noise-canceling earmuffs, because once they undergo that apoptosis, the physical mechanism is broken forever.
Okay, so since that physical damage can't be magically erased, dealing with tinnitus heavily relies on the human experience.
Right.
It stops being a biological problem and basically becomes a psychological battle, which honestly explains the massive disconnect between patients and their doctors.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the most significant hurdles in audiology today. I mean, only about 10 to 15% of people who have tinnitus actually seek medical help.
Which is incredibly low. And the ones who do are usually suffering deeply. The research maps this out using the World Health Organization's metrics for severe functional impairment.
Yeah, it's not just a minor annoyance for these folks.
No, this phantom noise ruins sleep. It completely shatters concentration, and it actively harms socialization.
Because think about it. If you constantly hear a high-pitched whine, and you can't decipher the consonants of the people talking to you anyway,
you're naturally going to stop going out. You stop going to crowded restaurants or parties. You just isolate yourself.
Exactly. But when these highly distressed people finally seek help, they run into a massive expectation gap.
Right, the Hussein study from 2018.
Yes. The clinical surveys spell this out perfectly. A patient walks into the clinic, and they expect the treatment to physically eliminate the perceptual sound.
They want a cure.
They want a pill or a surgery, anything, to make the ringing stop entirely.
Mm.
But the audiologists, they are almost entirely focused on changing the patient's reaction to the sound.
Okay, let me see if I have this right. It's like hiring a plumber to fix a dripping faucet in your kitchen.
Okay.
But instead of actually tightening the pipe to stop the leak, the plumber just hands you a pair of noise-canceling headphones and says, like, hey, you just need to learn to ignore the dripping.
Yeah.
I can absolutely see why a patient would feel completely dismissed by that.
It does feel dismissive to a suffering patient. Absolutely. But the audiologist's approach is grounded in the hard neurobiological reality we just talked about.
Because the hair cells are dead.
Right. They know the faucet cannot be physically fixed. So, to continue your analogy, if you can't stop the drip, you have to ensure the sound of the drip doesn't drive the homeowner to a nervous breakdown.
Right.
The notes visualize this with a clinical decision-making tree. When patients come in, they're triaged into three distinct categories: curious, concerned, and distressed.
I imagine the curious and concerned probably just need basic information, like reassurance that they aren't going deaf or losing their minds.
Pretty much. But for the distressed.
Right. What happens to them?
For the distressed, the intervention is about intense psychological counseling and sound therapy. The notes actually quote clinical psychologist Dr. Jennifer Ganz, who has this beautiful way of framing the cognitive behavioral approach for patients.
What does she say?
She says, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn how to surf.
Wow. I love that.
Yeah. The goal of therapy isn't to magically silence the noise. The goal is to decouple the noise from the body's physical fight-or-flight anxiety response.
Okay, so what does this all mean for the patients who are actually trying to surf? Are there specific individual traits that make someone better at riding those waves while others just get pulled under?
The clinical data on this is highly revealing, actually. Researchers have looked extensively at individual predictors of treatment success.
Mm.
They found that responders to sound therapy and counseling, the people who successfully learn to surf, tend to be younger and they have had their tinnitus for a shorter duration of time.
Well, the age factor makes total sense. I mean, a younger brain is simply more neuroplastic, and the habit of stressing over the sound just hasn't been locked into the neural pathways for decades.
Exactly.
But there was another predictor in the data that I found highly counterintuitive. The patients who responded best to psychological treatment were those who perceived their tinnitus as being located in the head rather than in the ears. Why would thinking the sound is in your head make it easier to treat? That feels backward.
It is a subtle distinction, but a profound one for the recovery process. If you feel the sound is physically located in your ears, you are fixated on a mechanical failure of a sensory organ.
You feel physically broken.
Right. But if you perceive it as being in your head, you are already subconsciously acknowledging it as a cognitive or perceptual phenomenon.
Oh.
You realize it's your brain creating the experience, which automatically makes you more receptive to psychological and cognitive therapies.
That makes total sense. You are reframing the battlefield. But let's look at the absolute extremes for a second.
Okay.
We know standard therapies like conventional hearing aids and sound generators provide relief. But what about extreme cases? Like, what happens when you use a cochlear implant?
Ah, yeah.
If someone is profoundly deaf and has severe tinnitus, a hearing aid won't work for them? Are they just out of luck?
This is where we look at some really surprising data surrounding cochlear implants. So cochlear implants are surgically implanted devices used for profound deafness. They bypass the dead hair cells entirely and directly stimulate the auditory nerve with electrical impulses.
Right, and the data on these patients is wild. First off, over half of adult cochlear implant users have persistent tinnitus, and the psychological toll on them is massive.
Massive. Something like 75% of them have trouble sleeping.
And insomnia is a huge driver of tinnitus distress. Because if your brain doesn't get that deep restorative sleep phase, it just lacks the cognitive resilience to filter out the phantom noise during the day. It creates this vicious feedback loop.
Exactly. But the act of getting the cochlear implant often breaks that loop.
Really?
Yeah, activating a cochlear implant actually improves tinnitus severity in up to 95% of cases.
Wait, how does surgically implanting an electrode array calm the ringing?
Because it restores auditory input to a starting brain. You turn the implant on, the brain starts receiving actual meaningful sound signals again from the environment, and it stops frantically searching for the missing frequencies.
So the internal microphone gets turned back down?
Yes. The brain's localized anxiety and hyperactivity ease up because it's finally being fed the sensory input it's been craving.
That is amazing. But, you know, if restoring sensory input via an implant calms the brain's emotional distress, what happens if scientists just bypass the ear entirely and hack the nervous system directly? Like, could we just shut down the ringing?
This is where we leave conventional audiology and enter the totally sci-fi realm of targeted neural modulation. Now, just to clear the air, the notes are very explicit that so-called biologics, things like antioxidant supplements, vitamins, or ginkgo biloba, they have absolutely zero proven efficacy for tinnitus.
So they're essentially snake oil.
Pretty much. But physically modulating the brain's electrical signals, that is showing tremendous promise.
Because we aren't just relying on patient complaints anymore, right? We can actually see the tinnitus on brain scans now.
Yes, we can map it.
People with chronic tinnitus don't just have ringing ears. They have measurably abnormal brain waves. Their brains show abnormally high theta, gamma, and beta band activity.
Which are the signatures of hyperactivity.
Right. And they show suspiciously low alpha activity.
And alpha waves are the brain waves associated with relaxed, calm, resting states. So researchers have been utilizing repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, or RTMS.
Okay.
This involves placing an electromagnetic coil against the scalp. It delivers precise, painless magnetic pulses that pass through the skull and induce small electrical currents in targeted areas of the brain.
Oh.
By artificially increasing that auditory cortical alpha activity, they are practically forcing the brain into a relaxed state, and patients experience significant tinnitus relief.
The brain mapping studies on this are absolutely fascinating to look at. When they look at the good surfers, you know, the patients who have tinnitus but low emotional distress, those individuals are heavily utilizing the frontal regions of their brain.
Which makes sense.
Because the frontal lobe is the executive center, right?
Yeah.
It handles logic, impulse control, and emotional regulation. So they hear the sound, they analyze it logically, and they dismiss it.
Yeah.
But the highly distressed patients, their brain activity is entirely centered in the limbic system.
And the limbic system is the primitive emotional fear center of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
It is responsible for the fight-or-flight reflex.
So the distressed patients aren't processing the phantom sound logically at all. Their limbic system is interpreting the ringing as an active, ongoing threat.
Exactly.
It's reacting as if there is a tiger in the room 24 hours a day. Interestingly, there's a strong correlation between high physical activity and lower tinnitus distress. Exercise literally strengthens those frontal regulatory pathways, allowing logic to override the limbic panic.
Which is great. But to truly intervene at a systemic level, we have to look at the vagus nerve.
Okay, let's go there.
The clinical notes highlight this truly groundbreaking study done in 2010 by engineer and colleagues. They didn't do this on humans. They used animal models, specifically rats.
Okay, but how do they even test this? Like, you obviously can't ask a rat if its ears are ringing.
Right, exactly. So they use behavioral conditioning. They train the rats to respond to certain quiet gaps in background noise.
Gotcha.
When you expose the rats to intense acoustic trauma, giving them severe noise-induced hearing loss, they stop responding to those quiet gaps.
Because the ringing in their own head fills the silence.
Precisely. Their auditory neural activity becomes completely pathological.
So the researchers have these rats with severe tinnitus. Then what? They introduce vagus nerve stimulation, or VNS.
Yep.
They play a specific therapeutic audio tone to the rat, and at the exact same millisecond, they deliver a tiny electrical zap directly to the rat's vagus nerve.
And just for context, the vagus nerve is the absolute superhighway of the parasympathetic nervous system. It originates in the brainstem and wanders all the way down through the neck to the abdomen.
Right.
It controls rest, digestion, heart rate, and crucially, the release of neuromodulators that govern neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to rewire itself.
Here is where it gets really interesting to me. So by playing the tone and stimulating the vagus nerve simultaneously, it essentially acts like a factory reset button.
Yeah.
You play a therapeutic tone, zap the nerve, release a flood of these plasticity chemicals, and basically force the brain's soundboard to recalibrate.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it.
Yeah.
By pairing the acoustic sound with the precise vagus nerve stimulation, the researchers literally reversed the pathological neural activity. They completely eliminated the noise-induced tinnitus in the rats.
That is incredible. The brain just deletes the phantom signal.
It overrode its own error.
Yeah, okay.
Now, it is a massive breakthrough, though it is important to temper our expectations for immediate clinical use, of course. Surgically implanted vagus nerve stimulation is still not FDA approved as a standalone cure for human tinnitus. However, we are seeing the rapid emergence of non-invasive versions.
Like what?
Devices utilizing transcutaneous stimulation TVNS or targeted bimodal plasticity devices like the Neuromod Linear System. These devices combine mild electrical stimulation on the tongue with specific audio tones played through headphones to modulate those beta and gamma brainwaves.
Wow.
They don't cure it instantly, but they are showing moderate, very real benefits for patients trying to turn down the volume.
So we are literally learning how to hack the brain's electrical signals.
We are.
But if we want to understand the complete picture of why this happens in the first place, we also have to look at the literal biological blueprint, our DNA.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it really begs the question, why do some people go to one loud rock concert and develop permanent ringing, while others work in loud construction zones for decades and hear just fine?
Yeah, genetics plays a much larger role than the medical community previously understood. The notes cite a longitudinal twin study by Bogo and colleagues analyzing monozygotic identical twins who share 100% of their DNA and comparing them against dizygotic or fraternal twins.
And twin studies are always the absolute gold standard for separating biological nature from environmental nurture.
Precisely. And this study proved beyond a doubt that there is a clear, undeniable genetic heritability to tinnitus. It isn't just about what environments you expose yourself to.
Right.
The presence of tinnitus is tightly linked to how fast a person's hearing naturally deteriorates over time, which is programmed into your genes.
The notes actually isolate specific genetic mechanisms too, right? Like the mutation in the otoferlin gene at position 2P23?
Yes. That specific gene is responsible for creating a protein that is crucial for the synaptic communication of the inner hair cells. It acts as the functional glue that allows the cell to transmit sound. If you have a mutation in that gene, which is known to cause deafness, particularly documented in consanguineous families from the Middle East, that communication breaks down under environmental stress much faster than someone without the mutation.
Wow.
So tinnitus isn't just about the noise you endure. It's about what your cells are genetically programmed to withstand.
But, you know, genetics still doesn't explain the strangest part of this condition. I was looking at the notes on the rarest manifestations, things like gaze evoked and orofacial or jaw evoked tinnitus.
Oh, yeah, these are bizarre.
Let me get this straight. For some people, just looking to the side with their eyes or moving their jaw to chew physically makes their ears ring louder.
Yep.
How on earth do the optic nerve or the jaw muscles cross wires with auditory perception?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture of everything we've discussed today, these strange anomalies are the ultimate proof of what tinnitus truly is. It proves tinnitus is not just an ear problem.
The damaged ear is just the inciting incident.
Exactly. Tinnitus is a complex whole brain, whole body sensory networking error.
So the brain is so desperate for an input signal that when the ear stops providing it, the auditory cortex starts reaching out and borrowing electrical signals from neighboring sensory systems.
Yes.
It physically taps into the somatosensory nerves of the jaw or the visual processing centers of the eyes.
It is a testament to how adaptable and sometimes how tragically flawed human neuroplasticity can be when it goes into overdrive.
Yeah. So to bring this all together for you listening, we have traveled from the microscopic, irreversible death of hair cells deep inside the cochlea to the psychological realization that treating tinnitus often means learning to surf the waves of phantom noise rather than trying to drain the ocean.
Right.
We've looked at how restoring physical hearing with implants can calm a panicked brain and how futuristic treatments pairing sound with vagus nerve stimulation are literally trying to factory reset the cerebral cortex.
And we are truly on the precipice of some revolutionary treatments.
Yeah.
Which honestly leaves us with a rather profound implication to consider as we wrap up.
Lay it on us.
If researchers are successfully using targeted vagus nerve stimulation paired with specific sensory inputs to literally erase phantom noises by overriding pathological brain activity, what does this mean for the future of human suffering?
Oh, wow.
Right. Could this exact same concept of targeted neuroplasticity soon be used to unplug other phantom misfires in the human brain? Could we use this exact mechanism of zapping the vagus nerve while introducing a trigger to overwrite chronic nerve pain?
Or erase the intrusive flashbacks of PTSD.
Exactly. Or shut down the paralyzing physical feedback loops of severe anxiety.
That is an incredible thought to end on, because if we can teach the brain to unhear a sound that doesn't actually exist, maybe we can teach it to unfeel a pain that has no physical source.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Protect your ears, invest in some good earplugs, and keep your minds open to the science of tomorrow, because the next time you hear a sound in an empty room, just remember, it might just be your own brain trying a little too hard to listen.